survey what's out there. How do people learn this? What are the different resources? What do people who actually know something about it think about those resources? Because I think, especially for, let's call them like hobby skills, you have a range of qualities. So sometimes, like for instance, I'm somewhat of a critic of Duolingo, but like that's an example where if you did some research and you looked into it, you might come up with a different perspective on things.
Today's guest is best known for the MIT Challenge. That's completing a 4-year computer science curriculum at MIT in just 1 year. He's an expert on acquiring skills from drawing to speaking Mandarin Chinese, and his book Ultra Learning dives deep into his toolkit for acquiring skills. This is the Brad Carr Podcast, and now here's Scott Young. Well, Scott, we've heard of layoffs at Amazon, Google, Twitter. For you, from your place of understanding building new skills, what do you think is the first thing people should be doing when getting ready to go out and look for new jobs?
I think it can be difficult, you know, when you are comfortable in some sort of working environment, then you have to collect up your wares, so to speak, and take it somewhere else and be like, this is how I could be useful. It's hard. And I know we were talking before the episode started recording that, you know, I remember, you know, I came out of college right during the Great Recession. So I really remember that bear market, like no one's getting a job. It's impossible to get hired. And as recently as like last summer, the labor market was so hot that, you know, you almost felt superfluous, like, oh, how do you get a job? Like, I don't know. Just like people are like begging you to work for them. So we've been in such a tumultuous period this last like couple of years with COVID and then the inflation and now raising interest rates, recession. Like it's crazy. It's hard to know what to expect. And so I think when you're in that kind of chaotic environment, you want to be focusing on how can I build durable skills? How can I build things that are going to last me a lifetime and not just, you know, for the next 3 months, the next 6 months. And so, you know, obviously the tech layoffs, you know, they're going to hit people. Like if you were maybe not the, you know, star of your team, then maybe you're going to get dropped. You're going to be pushed aside. If you were sort of, you know, not to say that every place works on seniority, but there certainly is a little bit of a, you know, first one in, first one out kind of feeling. So if you are a recent grad, if you're still training, you're still learning yourself, you might have gotten washed out in all of this. And, you know, there's also going to be compression probably on salaries. There's going to be compression on, you know, how many things you can ask for when you're in the labor market. And so I think when you're going into that situation, you really want to be presenting yourself as like, I am a useful candidate. I can hit the ground running. I'm someone who can contribute productively to whatever enterprise is. And learning is a huge part of that.
And with the people who you've worked with and featured in your book, what would be a good example of someone who's done that well?
Yeah. So a good example I like is, and actually I'm good friends with him, is Vat Jaswal. And he was training to be an architect. And this was shortly after the, you know, Great Recession, and architecture kind of, it's like the apex predator of careers. You know, the first thing that goes when you have a recession is people don't build giant buildings, right? Like they don't have the money, the interest rates are too high, you know, it's like the tertiary predator that gets wiped out. And so the architecture field had just been like hemorrhaging employees. So there's all these people with a decade of experience and credentials who are, you know, in the waiting. So if you are hiring anyone, you're going to hire back those people who are currently waiting. You're not going to hire someone who, well, I don't know how to do anything useful. I don't have any skills, but, you know, I could maybe contribute, you know, 6 months, a year, 5 years from now. You know, I think in good economic times, not only is there more competition for these people who already have experience, so employers are more willing to kind of say, all right, yeah, we'll train you. And then also there's more of a long-term outlook, right? Like if you are focused on the long-term future and not survival, you're also picking up employees that are going to be, okay, well, we'll grow you into this position. Maybe you're not that useful right now. And so I think in Vat's case, he had done a design degree, which is not like, you know, not like a community college technical certification. And so he had these sort of design theory, which, you know, would be helpful in the long-term for making him a good architect, but was like utterly useless for being an entry-level person working at a firm. And so what he did was he was like, well, I know what the competition is like. I know that I'm only going to get hired if I'm like immediately useful. He just figured out, okay, well, this is the software people are using. I think he was working at a print shop at the time where they were like doing large form blueprint printing. So he could see what kinds of stuff they were printing out there. And he's like, well, I'm going to make my portfolio so it looks like this, so I can do the work that they're doing. And so he, you know, did a project on his own where he designed his own building, and he did it with the software they're using. This was Revit, which is a popular architectural modeling software. Learned that on his own. I think he did the course, and then he worked on his building, and he made his portfolio look like the kind of stuff that was coming to the print shop. So it had like kind of the detail and stuff, as opposed to being, you know, sometimes you can go to a design class and you'll make stuff out of like cardboard and plaster and whatnot, because it's mostly about the creative artistic expression and not the technical interpretation. But I mean, if you're getting hired, they want the person who can interpret it technically right away. And he did this project, he had this portfolio, and he went and he pitched himself to two people, and they both were like, yeah, sure, we'll hire you. And so he had two part-time jobs, and then eventually he like transitioned into doing other work. And so I think the real lesson here is that in bad economic times, you need to ask yourself, how can I be immediately useful? How can I be not someone which is an investment, but someone who has like immediate return? And I think for a lot of sophisticated skill sets, this can be quite difficult, because what you learn in school tends to be this sort of long-term preparation activities. It's like, you know, you go to business school and they teach you about like how to manage a company, but no one who's just out of business school is managing anything. You know, you are doing paperwork, you're doing filing, you're doing sales calls. You want to show people, hey, look, you hire me and I'm going to be able to do that, and I'm going to be able to do it well right away. And so I think that's a very important skill to sort of work on, is to figure out, okay, who's hiring, what are they hiring for, and how can I be immediately useful?
So that gets to a broad concept that you're touching on. What is it about universities in general that makes them ineffective for getting grads prepared and skilled to go out into the job market?
You know, I think my viewpoints on this have shifted quite a bit over time, because I think I felt some sort of tension. I think there's some people who rightfully complain that a lot of what universities teach is somewhat impractical, right? That a lot of the sort of curricula even if you're studying engineering or you're studying computer science, let's say, is going to be, you know, like I did this MIT Challenge project, and a big part of that was, you know, I'm learning about like, you know, advanced algorithms and doing these sort of like computer science proof by induction that like some sort of algorithm guarantees determining. Like, this is not what you're getting hired for most entry-level computer science jobs. Now, I think I used to take a little bit more of a critical stance toward this, like, why aren't universities teaching sort of the relevant job skills? But now I see it again at this sort of trade-off level, that I think the difficulty is that to be an expert, to be someone who has sophisticated knowledge that they can perform well, so not, you know, university grad, you need to know a lot of things. You need to have a lot of knowledge. And so given that you only have 4 years, and that, you know, you have these classes, which admittedly, like, you know, maybe you're sitting in a lecture and then you have a couple homework assignments. Like, it's not the same as, you know, intensive 40 hours of constant work, of constant learning. You have a choice about what you're going to teach. And so I think some institutions, they sort of prioritize the get you ready for a job immediately stuff. And then other institutions are more like, well, let's teach you the stuff that you're unlikely to pick up on the job, sort of the deeper theory, this kind of thing. And so I think there's merits to both approaches. But I think the difficulty is that, you know, if you are a student and you find yourself in a situation where, okay, yeah, I spent time in university and I learned some of these sort of abstract things that might suit me well 10 years from now, but I don't know how to be useful on the job right away, there can be this gap. And I really like the Wharton professor, Peter Capelli, because he wrote a book, again, sort of in the Great Recession, about why people were, you know, struggling to find jobs. And he argues that, you know, it's often blamed on a skills gap. Like, all these kids these days, they don't have the skills. And he argues, I think correctly, that, well, it's also a training gap. That this is also the issue, that employers, they don't want to cultivate you, you know, for, you know, months and years in their company. They want you to be productive immediately. And so I think that's an economic shift we've seen over the last several decades, is that people move around companies more frequently, and you are not going to be a lifetime employee with a pension necessarily at a given company. And because of this turnover, employees don't really want to invest in making you this super productive programmer and then have you leave for a job paying twice as much to someone else who didn't invest anything in you. And so, unfortunately, this puts more and more of the onus on getting trained, getting ready on ourselves. And so universities and colleges, I think, you know, I do think they're doing their best. I do think that they are doing what they can to try to prepare you, but it just takes a lot to prepare people. And so I think the more you can have the mindset of taking ownership of your education and your skills and really working backwards at what do I need to know? How do I get proficient at things? I think I can really augment what you're learning in school. And it can also help you identify, okay, you know, this is the things that are going to be missing because, you know, my school like that decided to focus on design theory and not architectural software, which is a valid choice, but it also meant that, you know, he wasn't very useful to employers immediately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that private sector training trade-off that you mentioned is interesting to me because I used to be an officer in the Navy. And part of the deal was if the Navy trains you to be a pilot and spend $1 million to train you, you're also on a 10-year contract where you're not going to fly for the airlines, you know, anytime in the next 10 years. Scott, if you were to run a university, if there was Ultra Learning University, Scott Young University, what would you do to make it best?
You know, again, this is something that I've changed my thoughts on somewhat over time. I think the major difficulty that we have in education is that it's not entirely clear exactly what knowledge experts or people who are proficient at skills are actually using to perform those skills. So there's this subfield, which I think find very interesting, called cognitive task analysis. And this is this approach where psychologists and other practitioners go in and they interview people who are good at what they do. And they try to figure out what is the knowledge they're using? What are the mental models they have? What are the procedures that they follow? Like what is in their brain that allows them to be good at that? And I think the problem is that there's a real question mark there as to what is being used, what's not being used. And so instead, I think what you have in universities is that you have a mixture of tradition. So this is what we've always taught. So you can think about like Latin being taught in universities like way, way longer than it probably should have when it was like no longer the language of science and no one's speaking it. Like it just became this, well, Latin is what you learn in university. And so that's what we're going to teach you. So there's a mixture of tradition. There's a mixture of, I'll call it like high culture. You know, this is stuff that's considered to be like important, sophisticated, part of being an educated member of society, which is often just about like, you know, knowing things that uneducated people don't know. And so you can kind of puff yourself up a little bit about that. And then I think there's also, you know, genuinely, okay, people from industry are saying we need to learn this, we need to learn that. So there is this sort of mixture of factors, but I think there is a real gap. So there are areas where people have done these sort of cognitive task analyses and they've done these sort of rigorous tests. And so there are narrow areas where we actually do have a pretty good idea of this is the right way to teach it. So I think my favorite example of that is learning to read, for instance. We know that like teaching phonics is pretty important. And this is because learning to read is something like everyone does. This is a huge investment in infrastructure to figure out, okay, learning the sort of sound letter correspondences, learning those individually, and then learning to read. This is like the correct way to do it. But we don't know that for lots of other things. It's a lot of guesswork. And so I think that is an area where I feel like the education is more art than science. And so I think if I were trying to start a school or trying to start a university, that would probably be where I would start, is would be looking at, okay, what are the things that, you know, if you are a successful accountant, if you are a successful doctor, if you are a successful lawyer, programmer, what are the things that you're actually using in terms of mental models, understandings on a day-to-day basis that makes you proficient at your job? And my guess is that some of the stuff from universities would stick around. I think if you were a programmer, you'd definitely learn about loops and if statements and all those kinds of things. But I mean, maybe there'd be stuff that would be unexpected. Maybe it's really important to like, you know, learn certain ways of like how to debug programs that maybe don't get taught in school because you're doing these individual projects and you never get to read anyone else's buggy code. But that's mostly what you're doing when you're a professional programmer. So I think there's things like that where we could probably improve. But again, I think the real exciting thing maybe is just that we don't actually know. We don't actually know what, like, this is what needs to be taught. Like, these are the how you should prioritize it. And so I think if I were going in that direction, I think that would be where I'd want to start. It would be sort of figure out, okay, let's invest some resources in figuring out what's the right way to, how do people actually perform these skills? What knowledge do they need? And then like actually test out, this is what we should be presenting of our limited time to educate people. This is what is most important, most useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's get into some of the nitty gritty of where do we start? Yeah. So with a self-directed learning project, where should people start?
Well, it depends on the project. I think for well-defined skills, so by a well-defined skill, I mean like French or accounting or calculus or something where like you can go online and find classes and there's many different things to choose from, then for those kinds of skills, I usually start by looking at the resources. So in my book, I talk about meta learning, which is this sort of preliminary stage where you sort of survey what's out there. How do people learn this? What are the different resources? What do people who actually know something about it think about those resources? Because I think especially for, let's call them like hobby skills, you have a range of qualities. So sometimes, like for instance, I'm somewhat of a critic of Duolingo. Duolingo is like what everyone does now if they're like kind of vaguely interested in learning a language. I don't think it's very effective. I don't like it very much. And most of the people I know that are like really into learning languages don't really use a lot of Duolingo. I mean, maybe there's exceptions and I'm gone. And the technology is changing always. So maybe this will be out of date by the time it's published. But like that's an example where if you did some research and you looked into it, you might come up with a different perspective on things than if you were just, you know, okay, this is what everyone else is doing. So I think the meta learning stage is about researching, you know, what kinds of classes, what kind of material is there? How do people learn this? And I think this is very true for well-defined skills. For less well-defined skills, for instance, like how do I get a job at Google or how do I, you know, it's not quite clear what you need to learn. Then I usually go to the source, find people who have already learned it. My sort of rule of thumb is like people 2 to 3 steps ahead of you. So they should have learned it relatively recently, not, you know, they've learned it so long ago that they can't even remember what it was like to learn it. But they should be, you know, someone that you can access and figure out, well, what is it that they did? So for learning projects, you can actually sort of ask them what materials they used or what did they do to study for a particular test? What did they do to prepare? But for really ill-defined skills, it's often just useful to figure out what the path is for success in that domain. So if I wanted to launch a new business, for instance, I wouldn't be like, how did you learn about business? I would be like, well, what steps did you take to launch this business? Because that sort of indirectly shows what you would have had to learn about. Like, okay, well, I set up a company and I made a website and I did. And then you kind of have to piece together, okay, well, I have to learn a little bit about how do you incorporate or how do you, you know, buy a domain name or these kinds of things. And so that's another way of doing it. And so I think the more you are in a well-defined skill, you're looking for materials, books, courses, classes, sometimes software and applications, and you want to sort of read reviews, figure out what people who actually are good at the skill think about these things. And then for the ill-defined skills, you want to be focusing on the expert model or the person who's 2 to 3 steps ahead of you, figure out how they did it, look at their path, and that will help you hone in on what kinds of things you need to learn about.
I'm curious about soft skills in general. We're talking about the job market. I'm thinking management, leadership, sales. Mm-hmm. These things are maybe more nebulous. How would you get on a project to get great at something like that?
I think a lot of soft skills are things that you learn by doing them to a certain extent. They're less cognitive, I put it that way, that a lot of, I think, what you acquire when you do these skills is, first of all, kind of confidence for doing them. Because, you know, public speaking, for instance, I would say public speaking is like 80% being confident on stage. Like, yeah, there is a technique to it. So I don't want to say everyone who's confident is a good speaker, but the major bottleneck is that people aren't confident doing it, right? And so similarly with like leading a project and doing these things, yeah, you can be a bad leader for sure. And I don't want to say that there's no technical skill there, but if you've never done it before, you've never had any experience, often that lack of confidence, that lack of just sort of like basic familiarity is a bigger problem. And so I think just getting that sort of basic experience is a big part. So if, you know, for public speaking, for instance, like I highly recommend Toastmasters, because you can go there and just like get your reps in, just do lots of speeches until it feels normal to do speeches. I am someone who gives speeches, right? Even if you're an introvert or shy or whatever. If you are trying to get into sales, for instance, like volunteer for a charity doing like telephone asking for donations, like that will break you of the getting hung up, getting rejected. You know, be one of those people on the street that like stops passerbys and like, hey, you know, can I get you interested in this charity or something like this? Because again, dealing with the emotional difficulties is most of it. No, it's not going to tell you how to be like an excellent, you know, customer liaison for software, but it's going to give you that sort of basic confidence. And that's often what you need when you're in a job interview so you can do like the actual job and get the actual training and skills. And I think, you know, same thing for leadership, same thing for these, is that you need to have the experience. And so I think this is why when employers and these kind of people are looking at soft skills, they're usually looking at your track record, right? When they look at your resume, they're like, oh yeah, this guy has, led these teams and done these sort of outcomes over the last 10 years. So we'll hire this guy or gal for the position. And that's how it often works. And so it's not usually the case that, like, oh yeah, I have this, leadership certificate from the Institute of what, like, no one cares about that. Right. And I think that is because a lot of these skills are they're sort of tacit. They're things that you learn through doing them quite a bit. And so that's how I would approach soft skills. I think if you've already got that experience, or you've already got sort of that basic, you know, I've given 10 speeches, then getting into the mechanics, then getting the, like, you know, recording yourself, giving feedback, focusing on your style, like this kind of fine tuning and stuff can be more relevant. But, you know, if you haven't even done that, then that's sort of like that's kind of an advanced step. That's not really something you need to start with.
So with these tasks, once we've done this sort of meta level stuff, and then we want to get into getting our reps, practicing, yes, learning, taking feedback, what's the next phase of that look like for best results?
I have a sort of like really basic model that I think works really well for a lot of skills, which is that you basically need to see how other people do it. You need to do it yourself, and you need to get high quality feedback. And I think if you can keep your eye on those three ingredients, that's going to get you most of the way in most skills. Like, there's going to be specifics for very specific skills, so that, you know, are not generally across the board. But I mean, if you wanted to be a good writer, for instance, you need to read a lot of books, see how other people write it, figure out what patterns they're using, what's the kind of template, how do they do it. You need to write a lot yourself, and you need to get feedback. And so usually when someone's having a problem learning, I would diagnose the locus of the problem in one of those three things. Either you're not able to see how people who are good at it do it, so you're just guessing. You aren't able to do it yourself, maybe because, you know, you're restricted. You're not able to, like, you know, if you want to practice public speaking, but you don't have an opportunity to give a speech, or you want to do a certain kind of programming, but you can't work at that company, or you don't have feedback. So that includes not only the kind of, like, this is how you should do it feedback from a coach or a mentor or a peer, but even just like direct feedback from the reality you're trying to influence. So if you're an entrepreneur and you're not getting feedback about whether people like your products, it's going to be very hard to hone in on what kind of product you need to make. So I think if you think about it in that way, that would just be the sort of checklist to go through when you're evaluating some skill you're working on. Do you have those three ingredients? And if you don't, then it's going to be hard to learn something.
Once we've got these three ingredients kind of baked in, we're going through our cycles, we're getting feedback. What comes next to refine it, maybe to course correct?
You know, one of the things that I notice that you talk to people about, like mastery, for instance, and people want to be excellent and they want to be really good at something. And I think there is an important distinction between skills that it's important to be good enough at and skills where, you know, you need to be kind of the best in the world. And I think that the reason for this is that as you get better and better in a skill, essentially you're making smaller and smaller adjustments. So each unit of effort translates to like less and less improvement usually. And so this is why, like, if you're learning a language, for instance, like the first 1,000 words are going to come up all the time. If you learn those and you're fluent with them, you can deal with a range of situations. But the 10,000th word doesn't come up that often. So it's the same amount of effort to learn the 10,000th word, but it's like much less useful than the, you know, second or third most common word. And this kind of just tapers off. And so, you know, I talk to people who will be, you know, let's say learning a language, and they'll get in this kind of stuck state where they're like, well, I'm not as good as I'd like to be. And I think the issue here is just, you have to ask yourself, what do you want to really get good at? Because to get to past that point, once you sort of gotten to that good enough stage, then yeah, the only way you could do it is just doing lots and lots and lots of practice. So I don't think that it's that the ingredients change. I don't think it's that, okay, once you do this sort of get basic reps, there's like a totally different style of learning. It's just, you got to do way more of it, and you got to focus on increasingly minute corrections. You know, think about doing a class. Like if you're doing some, you know, test where there's a lot of material that's possibly covered, like getting to where you're getting 85% on the test is, you know, not going to be so hard, but getting to a thing where you get 100% every single time is going to be harder because you can't make any mistakes anymore. Right. And so I think that's true of a lot of skills. And so I think it's important to look at kind of, well, what's my criteria? What am I trying to do? And I think for a lot of professional skills, the bare truth of it is that good enough is good for a lot of skills. And so I think it's important to recognize, okay, when is this good enough? And when, you know, when do I actually need to be the best in the world at it? And I think sometimes people confuse that question, because if it takes 10 times as much effort to be the best in the world at a very narrow skill, you might actually be better off if you're like, you know, good enough at like 8 things that are necessary to be broadly competent in the workplace or to be able to achieve something. And so I think that's a good distinction, because yeah, once you get into the sort of, okay, I've gotten the good enough stage, then yeah, it's a lot of effort to get to that perfection, if mm-hmm. it's even possible.
So when we've got to this good enough stage, you've studied in your books, a lot of folks who, you know, they do multiple projects like this, yourself included. Yeah. What do you do when one is over and then you want to get better at the next one? It seems there's an arc where the more of these sort of projects you do, the more capable you become at doing other things.
I do think there's sort of some controversy in psychology about like how much does learning to do one thing, like let's say I do a project learning French, and then how much is that going to improve me for learning Spanish or programming or salsa dancing or this kind of thing? And I tend to be more on the idea that, you know, at the basic level, like, you know, any words you learn in French are not going to help you at all for learning programming. You know, like, there's going to be real weird coincidence if that's the case. But I do think that the self-management skills, there's definitely some skills you have to learn about how to manage a project yourself. So it's about picking the goal, defining the timeline, setting up your schedule. There's certain reusable habits there, you know, like if you were spending 5 hours a week and you'd figured out a system to get 5 hours a week consistently learning programming, then it's not that hard to transfer that 5 hours a week to learning French, right? So I do think there is going to be some at the kind of self-regulatory level, there's going to be some amount of transfer. But I think that the right way to think about it is that what we're trying to learn when we're learning this sort of approach is, what is an approach that works for you that allows you to regularly tackle new skills? And so that's the kind of scaffolding. And the content of the skill is going to be different each time. And so that is going to be, I don't think there is really a case that, you know, because I learned French, I'm going to learn programming 10 times as fast. But if it's like, if I get my act together so I can learn French, then those same things should also help me with learning programming. And so I think that's really what you're focusing on when you're doing multiple projects, is you're figuring out, what is the way that I can get this learning done in my life? And especially because most of us spend a lot of our time in school, where a lot of that scaffolding is provided for us, there can be a bit of a deficit, I think, sometimes in that self-regulation. I mean, you know how you can take time to go classes, but, you know, for a lot of people, if they don't have an exam deadline, they have a very hard time motivating themselves to study. And so I think there is a skill there. There is a self-regulatory capacity of like, okay, how do I sit down and study this thing even though there's no deadline? And I think that's something that each person has to figure out for themselves through practice.
With that too, a lot of folks have talked about this sort of thing with, they mention energy being a thing. It's just they get tired of it. They get burned out. They get distracted. Yeah. What do you think people can do to manage their energy with learning new skills?
I think sometimes when people talk about energy, there is the genuine just being fatigued. So I don't want to, and learning is mentally taxing, so that itself can be draining. But I think it's more related to enthusiasm and motivation, because sometimes the idea of learning something is different from actually learning it. And so one approach is just to focus on, okay, this is going to be hard, but it's important for me. So if I'm learning a skill to get a job, let's say, I don't necessarily go into it with the expectation of, oh, this is going to be like playing video games for 3 hours and I'm just going to, you know, get enthralled by it. But I need to just set up a system so that I can do it. So in that way, it's like anything else that you kind of have to do in life, like a chore or exercise or something like this. Just try to make it as easy as possible for you. So set up your environment so that you don't have to like dig everything out, get everything set up each time. You can just go set fixed times in the day so it's consistent, and you kind of, okay, yeah, after work, I do this for an hour, or, you know, I wake up and I do this for half an hour. I do this during my lunch break. It's consistent. So I'm not making this mental decision each time whether I want to do it or not. And so these are ways to sort of deal with these learning tasks that you kind of have to do. But if it's not something you have to do, if it's something that, you know, you are doing because you're interested in it, then I do think there is there's an important part of learning is to figure out, what's a way of doing this that makes me excited? What's a way of doing this that's fun for me? And so things like, joining groups, social groups. Like that's a huge part of learning, because if you're doing it in isolation, often the motivation isn't there. Whereas, you know, if you're learning to salsa dance, if you're learning to go to public speaking and your friends are there and you're doing it, then, you know, it's a lot easier. And similarly, I think for skills like, let's say, painting, or if you're learning music or this kind of thing, finding some outlet where you enjoy the activity is really important, because otherwise, yeah, if it's just a grind for some, and you know, you've been grinding at it for a few months, yeah, you've gotten better, but you're not like excellent at it and this kind of thing, it's going to be hard to sustain that motivation. So I think if it's not something you have to do, then you have to find some way to make it something you like to do.
What do you think is the biggest pitfall that people deal with when going through these projects? Like, what's the big stumbling block?
Well, I do think there is a tendency to bite off more than you can chew. So like you get really excited about something that has this like huge scope, and then you approach it, you work on it for like 2 weeks, and then you're like, oh, this is too much effort, and you give up. Like that's from interacting with people, that's the most common pattern of failure. Mm-hmm. Is not really, oh, I tried my hardest and I couldn't do it, but just I started doing it and actually it's exhausting and I can't do it. And so this again goes to what I was talking about. This is why you need that scaffolding, and you need to learn how to create that scaffolding for yourself. I think this is particularly true for intellectually challenging skills. I think everyone has a certain cognitive effort threshold, where if it's below that threshold, you can kind of do it for fun, even if it's not like the most fun thing in the world. So there's books that you would just read, and you can just read it. It wouldn't be that hard for you. But then if it gets over a particular threshold of difficulty, all of a sudden, okay, now this is effortful. Like if this is not on my to-do list, I won't do it. I won't just do it spontaneously. And so I think it's important to recognize, okay, if it isn't something I'm going to do spontaneously because it's mentally demanding, then I need to really arrange my schedule, my life around making it happen. And often those little periods of frustration or effort, they're often narrower than we think they are, you know? So I think a real skill that people who are excellent self-directed learners have is sort of recognizing that, yeah, I'm going to suck at this for like a month, and it is going to be effort and work for a month. But once I'm past that, then I can actually just do it for fun. So I think, like, you know, the amount of really smart people who've told me, oh, I could never learn programming, I think it's because they don't want to get through that 1 month where they can't do anything and it's really difficult, and like getting the software set up is like just a pain. But if they could get through that, and then they were like working on things to like make their life easier or that were personally interesting, I think a lot of people could do it. Similarly for like drawing or learning a language is another example where, like, if you can't have any kind of conversation, learning a language is just sort of like this meaningless grind of like memorizing vocabulary and syntax and a few phrases. But if you can have like a 5-minute dialogue with someone where it's like about something that actually matters to you, that's super motivating. That's like, oh, great. This is, you know, this is awesome. If you can go on a trip somewhere and interact with someone who doesn't speak English, even if it's like, you know, for 30 seconds, that's great, right? Like that's the reason you're doing it. And so I think that's a big sort of concept, is like, how do you get through that frustration barrier? How do you sort of define what that frustration barrier is, and how do you push through it is a big part of that. And so I do think that's a real part of the strategy. Some people, they get really obsessed, so they have this kind of like intensity and energy that they push through that period. Other people, the way they do it is they just, you know, really make the surrounding difficulties as low as possible so that they can just really effortlessly engage with no expectation. So there's lots of different strategies there, but I think that's the identification of the problem, is that recognizing, okay, there's going to be this squeeze period where I'm going to have to struggle at it, you know, not do that well, but then after that, I'm going to start to enjoy it. And I think that's also an emotional reaction that you kind of have to learn through experience. So, you know, talking about the project to project, I think, you know, we can talk about this in the abstract. We can talk about how you need to get through this frustration barrier, but it's only when you've done it a couple times that you're like, oh yeah, yeah, I know this is going to be difficult right now. I know I'm doing snowboarding and I'm going to fall like 18 times the first day, but I know I'll be good at it later. Like, that's not something you can tell someone. They just have to feel it, right? It's like an emotional response from your direct lived experience. And so I do think that is one benefit of taking on these kind of projects, is that if you can be successful with a few of them, you do really have all this extra confidence that now you can tackle a lot of different things.
This idea of biting off more than you can chew, it seems that maybe a goal setting issue. Is there a way to set the appropriate goal to make sure that it works?
Well, I think there's a little bit of an art form in making goals that are small enough that they actually don't involve a huge investment, but are intriguing enough that you're motivated to pursue them. So that's the intersection of the Venn diagram that I think people struggle with, because it's easy to think of big goals that, like, that would be cool if I did it, right? Like, it would be cool if I were a doctor, right? Like, that would be, it would be cool if I were, you know, Elon Musk. Like, these are fantasies people have it's easy to see why that's compelling, but it involves like an insane amount of effort that's, you know, maybe not even reasonable given your circumstances, you know, like, you know, I talk to people sometimes who, like, they beat themselves up about not doing some skill, and then they list through their life constraints and you're kind of like, no, it sounds like you're making the right choice. Like, I don't know why you're feeling guilty about it. Like, I remember talking to one guy who was guilty about not learning Python programming. That was like one of the things he wanted to do. But I'm going through it and it's like, he's got kids, he's working a full-time job. He doesn't really have time and it's not very important. And so it just, to me, kind of felt like, oh, okay, well, that just makes sense as like a prioritization idea of why you wouldn't do that. So I don't think there needs to be that guilt involved. So for those kind of people, if you're imagining some really big goal and it just doesn't fit with your life, then the laziness is super rational. It's not like a defect. It's not like, oh, well, you don't have enough willpower. It's like, no. You just correctly assess that that's not a priority for you right now. So I think what you want to do is you want to be able to find those things that, like, okay, what could I do, you know, for half an hour a day for a month that would be still cool enough to, like, make that worth it. And so I think that is a lot of the design aspect of it. I spend a lot of time on these projects when I'm working on them on really designing the scope. Like, what exactly am I going to be doing in that period of time? Because yeah, if you have a year, you can take in a big ambitious scope, but if you don't and you're not working full time, you really have to be quite focused. You have to be like, okay, this is exactly what I want to get good at. And I think if you don't get that, this is exactly what I want to get good at clear enough, you do often end up with these sort of disappointing projects where you spend a lot of time on them, but any of the things that you thought you really cared about, you never really got good enough at them to like be self-sustaining. And, you know, it's hard to sustain the motivation. So when someone's talking about like, oh, I want to learn programming, I very rarely say, okay, I just want to learn programming. Okay, sure. Yeah, everyone needs to learn the basics. But if you were to say, I want to be able to write like the macro functions in Excel so I can like automate all my work. Okay, that is now a task that you can build up to that maybe, yeah, you could definitely do that in a month. Or I want to be able to, learn video editing so I can like edit some, you know, family photo albums or something like this into a little display video. Okay, that's definitely something that you could do in a month. I think once you kind of constrain this focus down to a, you know, an achievable goal, it's a lot easier to just go and do it. Whereas once you sort of, if you imagine it in this sort of broad terms, it's very difficult to set the scope that way where it actually makes sense for you to make that investment.
Mm-hmm. So Scott, you've done so many of these sort of projects. You're around a lot of people who do. What do you think makes a polymath someone who's done many of these projects?
I think polymathism is somewhat overestimated. I think a lot of people who look like polymaths actually have a few specialties that it looks like they're applying the same idea to lots of areas. So for instance, like Da Vinci is the like classic Renaissance man where you like point, oh, he was so good at all these things, but he was mainly good at design. That was what he was mainly good at, was design. And that influenced obviously his paintings, his inventions, and some of these other things. And like, that was sort of like a core skill that branched outward. And I think that's true of like, you know, the irony, so this is like, again, superficial differences, but you'd be surprised how many people who are really interested in linguistics and languages are also interested in computer science. They have a lot more overlap than you'd think. Similarly, like Thomas Edison, you know, the guy had invented so many different things, is like a fluoroscope for viewing x-rays and the phonograph, the first audio recorder, and, you know, of course, obviously worked on the incandescent light bulb. But again, you look at it, all of them stem from him being really good at like novel applications of electricity. So I think that's the first thing I would talk about, is that even people who are seemingly polymathic in their abilities usually have some sort of core discipline or strength that they then just apply more broadly. So that's one way you can get over this sort of trap, is if you develop some sort of core skill or mindset, then often there's sort of adjacent applications that span a large area, and you're able to do that without having to like just become a totally different kind of person. So I think that's one thing I would focus on being a polymath. And then the second thing I think is just you have to be someone who's broadly curious about things, that you know you want to know about everything, and you're okay being bad at things. You know, you're okay going back down to the beginning and being like, oh yeah, I know I'm in my mid 40s, but I'm gonna go and take this like class that I should have learned in high school. You know, that's the barrier I think for a lot of people, is that they're not willing to step down from their current position of competency and be like, yeah, you know I didn't learn this when I was a kid. You know, I'm not a good swimmer, for instance. I never learned to swim, but you know, I'm gonna be 50 and I'm gonna be like flopping around in the shallow end of the pool. Like that is an emotional skill that you have to kind of cultivate, of being like, you know what, being bad at things is okay.
This is interesting to hear you talk about now, because I'm starting to see other people through this lens. Like I was at a funeral for someone recently, and he was a politician. He was a school teacher. Yeah. He had a family. He was in the military. And now I'm seeing, oh, well, the through line was sort of leading and serving people. Like it looked like he had all these different things, but he had this one thing that he was really great at.
Yeah. And I mean, I think some of that is a natural skill. So some people do have natural skills. I'm definitely not on the camp that argues that everyone is blank slate identical. And, you know, if you fail to learn something, it's your fault. But I also think that, you know, some of this is cultivated ability. And I think it's just that, you know, if you spend a lot of time learning math, then there's going to be things that are adjacent to math that are going to be easier for you to learn, because you have all these overlapping components. One of my favorite examples of this is when we were doing the Year Without English language learning project, we went to Spain and we had just started learning Spanish. We did do a little prep at home, but not tons. And we're meeting other people who are also on, they're traveling from other places. And we met these Italian people and their Spanish was so good. And in my head at the time, the way I thought about it was, well, you know, the Europeans are just so good at learning languages. They just, you know, because it's so multilingual, you know, they just pick them up effortlessly. And it was only months after and traveling to Italy that you realize, like, actually Italian and Spanish are super close. Like you could meet Italian people who would understand what a Spanish person is saying, basic sentences, without knowing any Spanish at all. And so, you know, it's one of these things that like sometimes people pick up skills really quickly, and sometimes it's just that they're a genius or they're talented. I don't want to say that never happens, but a lot of times it's because, oh, actually you learned this like super similar skill before and there's quite a bit of overlap. And so yeah, naturally you're picking it up really quickly. And, you know, so another example of this is I had a friend who she got a master's in civil engineering. She's doing like complex, like fluid equations for water flow of these hydroelectric dams. And it's, you know, differential equations. It's like, this is complicated stuff, right? And she did that and she was an expert at it. And I remember her telling me with a straight face that she took an intro programming class in university and she was like, oh yeah, I wasn't smart enough to do that. And I was like, there's no way. And first of all, I would just, you know, my personal opinion is that computer science is at least at the level taught in the university is just actually objectively a bit easier than engineering and physics. But even if we just put that aside, there's no way that like a first year freshman programming class was gonna stump this woman. But I think what happened is that, you know, like a lot of people, she didn't have any programming experience. She goes to an intro programming class and who's there? All the nerds from high school that like spent like 4 years programming or doing related tech stuff. And so of course they picked it up really easily. It made sense to them. And it didn't make sense to her. And so she's comparing herself to these other people and is like, oh, I must not be smart enough for this. So I think that's something that you really need to watch out for. You know, we're talking about salsa dancing. You know, people don't come to the class and say, oh, here's my dance background, right? They're just saying, oh, I've never learned salsa dancing before. So you make this sort of equation that you are the same as that person. And so if you're struggling, I should just give up. I'm not good at this. But it may be more like the me meeting the Italians. And it's like, well, of course it's a bit easier for you. I just need to work a little bit harder at it. There's nothing wrong with me. And so I think that's an important part of the, you know, learning the adjacencies, learning the other skills, because once you learn more and more skills, you will find these overlaps. You will find this area where, like, if you know Chinese and you're learning Japanese, well, great. You already know most of the characters, right? Like, it's not starting from zero. You're starting already from the middle of it. And so I think as you learn more things, you can get that advantage, that sort of compound interest of knowledge growth that's so important for learning and we often underrate, and is often part of the reason why people think they're not smart enough, when really they just don't have the right background experience.
Yeah, this is making me think of Malcolm Gladwell's book, David and Goliath. And he basically says that relative success compared to the people who are around you can predict how long you'll persist. So for that woman who you mentioned, if she's in a room with a lot of people who are very quickly picking up those concepts, she might not have that relative success, and then she might be less likely to persist.
There's interesting research, a motivation I'm thinking of. I don't remember the author, but they have this, it's called Big Fish, Little Pond Effect, or is it Little Fish, Big Pond Effect? But it's this kind of idea of, like, your relative assessment of your ability. Because think about it this way, like, one of the ways that we are designed as creatures is that we're social animals. We understand that we fit into a niche, right? That, you know, even the hunter-gatherer tribe, like, there'd be the guy who's really good at shooting arrows, and there's the guy who's really good at telling stories. And, like, you figure out your role. You figure out the things that you're good at. And so I think we are innately equipped with this kind of idea of, you get into a situation and you figure out what I'm good at, what I'm not good at. And the thing is that we just don't know what the causal determinants of that is. So, like, if the reason you're good at it is because you have some innate ability that no one can replicate, then yeah, that probably is a good sign that you should pursue it. But if the reason that you're not good at it is because, well, these other people already had 5 years of experience, then that's maybe a misleading signal. Like, it's not necessarily, okay, well, I'd have to get that 5 years of experience to match them, so maybe that's not a cost I'm willing to bear for this. But I think it can be misleading, because people who have that prior experience can get themselves into situations where it just looks like they're really, really smart, but really they actually have acquired a lot of background knowledge. I mean, even just think about your ability to read, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we just take for granted, you know, most people are literate. But if you were illiterate, you know, you grew up in a society that didn't have writing or this kind of thing, you know, coping with the modern world, people would just think, oh, yeah, this person's not very smart, right? Mm-hmm. But it would have nothing to do with that. It's an entirely acquired skill. Like, until very recently, no one was literate. And same with mathematics. Like, I mean, if you have a, you know, deep math education and someone's speaking calculus and you just understand what they're saying, it's not because you're super brilliant. It's because, well, you have all this knowledge. And so I think this knowledge-based approach, where you're focusing on, you know, what is this background experience, that's the area that you can change the most. It's definitely the case. Some people have stronger spatial reasoning ability. Some people are able to, like, you know, mimic the sounds of another language, like a parrot, and they don't require any instruction. And other people, they're going to have a thick accent, whatever language they learn. There's definitely prior abilities, but I think we can't underrate the role of experience. And that's the lever that we actually have control over.
Mm-hmm. Scott, looking ahead, with now all the access to information that we have, you can just Google search anything. There's machine learning. There's more and more stuff now that's generative even. What do you think is the role of building skills as we go into a more technologically advanced future?
Oh, it's going to become more important. I think that's the big mistake people make. You know, you hear all this, like, oh, well, the AI is going to take our jobs. Like, this is like this line I heard. I remember I went to this this retreat once, and there was a guy who was making this big claim that, like, well, now because of AI, like, there's no point in becoming an accountant. And I do think it reflected a misunderstanding of what accountants do. It was mistaking an accountant with a bookkeeper and just someone who just enters things in a file, whereas an accountant is someone who reasons with the things that come from bookkeepers. But I think it's the opposite. I think as we become more technologically sophisticated, the demand for skills goes up. You need to be more sophisticated, not less, to live in a world with artificial intelligence. You need to, because you have to work with these things now, right? There used to be a lot of jobs that didn't require that much training to be good at, but people still had to do them. And as those get eaten up, it's going to be the more sophisticated skills that you need that require deeper understanding, that understand why the AI is breaking down in this situation. Like, that's the skill people are going to be paying for. And so I think we're in a situation where you need to know more. And I mean, you also mentioned the idea of, like, Google, and, like, you know, you have information at your fingertips. The problem is that if you have information at your fingertips, but you don't know what to look for, it might as well not exist. And that's a problem of the knowledge that's in your head. If you don't have knowledge in your head, if you don't have this kind of scaffolding of understanding of how the world works, you don't even know what to look for. You don't even know what it is that you're supposed to be searching for. And so I would say that the world we're living in is going to be one where people need far, far more education, far, far more knowledge, far, far more skills to be able to cope than less. And so far from being the case that, you know, all these new innovations are making learning redundant, they're making it far more important. And so this is a kind of, you know, it's a scary prospect, because it also means that, you know, there's more pressure on us to learn more skills, because we can't just, you know, have a high school diploma, show up at the factory and just be guaranteed a good job and pension for the rest of our lives. We have to be able to learn lots of things and be learning continuously.
Well, Scott, for people who want to be prepared for all of that, before I ask my last question, where should people look for you online?
Yeah, so you can go to my website at scotthyoung.com. That's scotthyoung.com. I have literally thousands of articles that I've written over the last nearly two decades on personal development, habits, learning, goal setting, a lot of these things. More recently, I've been focusing a lot on delving into some of the research behind this. So if you're interested in that, you can check that out. And also you can check out my book, Ultra Learning. You can get it on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, wherever you get your books. It's also on Audible. So if you're not sick of listening to me by now, you can you can listen to me some more.
Great. Well, we'll put links to all of that in the description for people to check out. And Scott, my final question is, for people right now, what do you think is the most important skill to be learning?
It's a hard question to answer, because I think that it's not a question of which skill people should be learning. It's that people should be learning lots of skills. And so I think the right way to approach it is just to focus on one skill at a time. And so the question is not what's the most important skill for anyone to learn. It's the question is, what should you learn next? And I think you can probably come up with some list of your own of what things you could be learning for your job, for your career, to move you forward, for hobbies, for things that, you know, to make your life more interesting. I think that's a huge part of it. And even just for your general knowledge. I mean, we live in chaotic, interesting times, and it takes a lot of understanding to even figure out what the heck's going on in the world. And so I think all of these things make learning important. And I think that's just, yeah, there's just lots and lots of stuff to learn. So it's not a question of what's the most important thing. It's just a question of getting started.
Maybe to make this a two-parter. So how are you approaching that right now? Sure. Like, what do you want to do next?
Well, I'm currently working on a book. And so that involves an enormous amount of research. So, you know, I just finished a chapter where I'm reading all the literature on creativity and, you know, people's different understandings of that. And there's lots of other topics that are in the book. And I think, you know, that's one thing that I've come to appreciate through doing this project is how much knowledge is out there. You know, like, people are kind of like speculate wildly, like, well, you know, I wonder what. Any question you can ask, someone has devoted their entire life to coming up with reasonable answers for it. And so I think the right attitude to have is not one of, you know, oh, well, whatever, who cares about what those people think, is to sort of be curious about it. You know, you can, for a very small amount of effort, acquire what it took, you know, multiple people, sometimes hundreds of people, entire lifetimes of thinking and experimenting and researching and puzzling through it to come up with answers. And so I think we just live in such privileged times that, you know, I can actually just type that in and get a few books and know what they know.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way to look at it. Thanks so much, Scott. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me, and I've really enjoyed reading your book and learning from you. Thank you.
Thanks for watching this episode. To help get more great guests on the show, be sure to subscribe.